Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Mark Gober. He is the author of An End to Upside-Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. Mark is an author whose worldview was turned upside down in late 2016 when he was exposed to world-changing science. After researching extensively, he wrote An End to Upside-Down Thinking to introduce the general public to these cutting-edge ideas, all in an effort to encourage a much-needed global shift in scientific and existential thinking. Mark has long sought answers to life's challenging questions. As an undergraduate at Princeton, he was drawn to astrophysics because he wanted to understand the universe. But because, due to commitments as a member of Princeton's Division I tennis team, he decided that astrophysics would be too demanding. So instead of studying the invisible forces that govern the universe, he studied the invisible forces that secretly drive human behavior, getting a degree in psychology and focusing on behavioral economics. After college, he explored the universe through books for fun, but it wasn't until the summer of 2016 that he randomly stumbled across a series of podcasts that exposed him to some radical new ideas. Those ideas put into question most of the common basic assumptions about who and what we are as human beings. The more he researched, the more he realized he needed to rethink everything he thought he knew. When Mark began relating to his friends his research, they told him it had changed the way they looked at life, and their lives started to improve. And just as a little note, when I put on Facebook about Mark being on the show today, one of those people whose lives was also changed by reading the book made a real quick comment stating just how much it happened for her. So when Mark isn't pursuing the world's biggest questions, he serves as a partner in Sherpa Technology Group, a firm that advises businesses on mergers and acquisitions and strategy. In recognition for Mark's singular work on the understanding of the nature of consciousness, Dr. Evan Lazio, a two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee, recently named him as the director of the Lazio Institute of New Paradigm Research, where Mark serves as the director of corporate relations. You can find out more about Mark by visiting his website, which is markgober.com, and that's markgober.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So, after that long introduction, hello, Mark. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure, and anytime we can help listeners think differently and think and do better, it's always a pleasure, and certainly your book has a way of getting people to do that. So I guess the first place to start, and I usually like to have my guests kind of give a little bit of a background about themselves and, you know, their personal and professional, you know, journey from where they started to how they got to this particular point, and in your case, author of An End to Upside-Down Thinking.
So you mentioned a little bit of it, but I'll go into a bit more detail. My perspective as of about 2 years ago was very conventional in terms of the way I thought about existence. And I thought that life had no meaning at all, because if you reason that the reason that we have consciousness is because of activity that's going on in our brains, then once the brain and the body die, then the consciousness also dies, meaning that all of your memories and awareness, they go away once a person dies. And if you really think about that, that the implications of that, then it's difficult, if not impossible, to come up with any meaning in your life. Because once you're dead, it's over. And that's what this traditional perspective that I think our education system and our scientific community is effectively promoting, which is that we're conscious because of our brains. So that's what I thought. I thought life had no meaning at all. And I wasn't looking for an alternative because I thought it was just scientific fact. And I didn't want to rationalize things and just try to come up with meaning to make myself feel better because I didn't think that was real.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you mentioned, I was at Princeton where I was on the tennis team, so I was very busy with that. And then I went into investment banking in New York during the financial crisis, actually. So that kept me very busy. And then for the last 8+ years, I've been with Sherpa Technology Group, where I'm a partner, and we advise technology companies. So when you listen to that kind of a background, it doesn't sound like something that has much to do with consciousness. It was about 2 years ago that I stumbled across podcasts. The initial one was called Healing Powers, a woman who claims she has psychic abilities and interviews other people who are psychic and can communicate with the deceased, things that I had never heard of before. And I wasn't convinced of anything when I initially heard these conversations. But after hearing enough of them, I became a bit confused because it seemed like there were people who weren't delusional and they didn't seem like they were lying. And I couldn't reason what they were saying because it didn't make any sense relative to my old worldview. So I decided to really explore. And the more I explored, looking at actual science, I saw there was a whole body of scientific evidence that I never knew about. And then I realized that most of my colleagues and former classmates, that they probably hadn't heard of either. So I really went deep into this for about a year straight, where outside of work, my main priority was to understand this alternative perspective on reality, which we'll discuss today. And it ultimately culminated in my writing the book, actually over a few weekends in July 2017. I just felt really compelled to get it all on paper. And so that's where we are today, where I have a very different worldview versus the kind of bleak outlook that I used to have.
Well, that's good. I mean, I find that it's interesting how, you know, so much of this information, the information that you research is available, but it's not promoted or it flies under the radar, you know, of so many people that it's, it's a good thing that you wrote this book, you know, to raise awareness. So what you said you did it in a few weekends. What was the process that you used for this?
So prior to writing the book, I never had an intention of writing something like this. It was not what I was really thinking about doing. But as you mentioned earlier, it was kind of the fact that so many different people that I had told about the information said that it had a positive effect on their lives. I realized that something seemed to be getting through to them, and I was passionate about the topic. So I said, okay, why don't I try to summarize my findings in a way that a person with a conventional background like mine could understand and not just dismiss it offhand? Because as you said, the research is out there. It's just for some reason swept under the rug. So I wanted to put the best research into one place so somebody else could read the book, hopefully in a short amount of time, and not have to do the year's worth of research that I did to find the best pieces. Because not all the research is good, I think there are pockets of really good stuff. So my process was, you know, I had a full year's worth of information in my head that I had sort of organized into a way that I thought could appeal to people. So it was, the first step was to create an outline and a flow for how things would work. And the book is structured, the meat of the book is structured by looking at individual phenomena, things that one might traditionally call paranormal, like psychic abilities, like the ability to survive bodily death. But each of these is its own chapter and has all the best evidence in the chapter. So it was a matter of just filling in those chapters over the course of a few weekends.
Yeah, and did you feel that it was essential to have that evidence-based approach rather than anecdotal types of, information in the book?
Absolutely. And the reason is that the anecdotal cases are typically criticized much more so than other types of studies. Now, some of the studies I talk about are inherently anecdotal, where it's just there are a lot of anecdotes that have been studied systematically by scientists, and I tried to bring those in. So the more studies that I could bring in that were peer-reviewed or done by very credible organizations, for example, the U.S. government. I show documents that have been declassified from the CIA that talk about certain psychic phenomena that are real, according to their research. Princeton University, the former dean of engineering, ran a 27-year lab at Princeton, and I chronicle some of that research. The University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies at the med school, they study things like near-death experiences and other phenomena that are considered paranormal, but that's a credible institution. So I tried to aggregate the best stuff that would appeal to the way our society thinks today, which likes to see studies that are in peer-reviewed journals done by scientists that they think are credible.
Yeah, that's great. You know, and it's sometimes hard to use the scientific method to measure and, quote, prove something that is inherently, you know, like paranormal, you know, outside of the normal. So I mean, you know, and I've talked to quite a few guests, you know, who are scientists who indicate that, you know, the scientific method sometimes needs to be tweaked in order to be able to measure the kind of phenomena that you're talking about in your book.
It's a very important point. So what I tried to do and what some scientists have tried to do is take what is observable and where we see an influence that is not explainable through conventional means. And if you take the accumulation of all of those different phenomena, it points strongly in this direction of non-physical influences. So it's not like it can be proven per se, but it strongly points in that direction if you look at these various studies, combined with the fact, and this is still something that I had, you know, it still blows my mind, the notion that we do not know scientifically how a brain could ever produce a non-physical consciousness. So I can touch my arm, I can touch my leg. If you ask me to touch my mind or my awareness, I can't do it. How does a body that's physical, you can touch it, how does it produce this non-physical consciousness? The open secret is we don't know the answer. It's called the hard problem of consciousness. And Science Magazine says it's the number two question that's still unanswered in science. So if we take that open question and say, look, there's this big question for something as obvious as our own consciousness, and we see these empirical results in different areas, when we combine that together, I think it's a reasonable inference to say that consciousness is existing outside of the body, though maybe we can't technically prove it. It's just strongly suggested.
Yeah, I agree. So now the title of the book is An End to Upside Down Thinking. So what do you mean by upside down thinking?
Kind of alluded to this, but the upside down thinking is a philosophy in science known as materialism. And I don't mean materialism as in liking material goods, although that's a byproduct of this. But what I mean is that it says the universe is fundamentally made of matter, physical material that you can touch. There was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago that filled the universe with this physical material that we call matter. And through random chemical reactions where this matter is interacting, we end up with DNA that leads to the evolution of a human being that develops a brain. And from the brain, consciousness comes out. Our subjective inner experience, our awareness, our mind comes out of the brain. So what I consider to be upside down thinking now is this idea that matter creates consciousness through a brain. And that is the conventional perspective of most of Western thinking and most of scientific thought, is that it's matter creates consciousness. I argue that that's upside down, that consciousness doesn't come from the brain. Rather, consciousness is at the very beginning of that whole chain I described. Consciousness is primary, existing beyond space and time, and the physical world, including biology and even brains, are experiences within consciousness.
Yeah, and I mean, that is upside down compared to what we've been taught and continuing to be taught. So the idea of consciousness, you know, that creating matter. What is your view of individual consciousness versus maybe, I think it was Jung that called the collective consciousness? So can you talk a little bit about the idea of exactly, maybe where does this consciousness either originate or what is the source of that consciousness?
The way I think about it, there's an analogy from Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, who wrote a book called Why Materialism is Baloney. So he and I agree on many things. But the analogy he gives is, imagine that reality is like a stream of water, where water represents consciousness. And each of us, this is getting to your point of individual consciousness, each of us is like a whirlpool. I'm one whirlpool, you're another. You know, each of us is a localized part of that stream. But fundamentally, we are still made of water. We're made of consciousness. So if we feel like we're having an individuated experience because we're in our own whirlpool, but we're still part of the stream. We're still part of the same underlying consciousness. And that's how I look at the different phenomena that I describe that seem paranormal. They're actually not paranormal if we consider the stream of consciousness to be existing. To your question on the origin of consciousness, this is something that I get to at the very end of the book. I do a question-answer segment because there are so many questions that people have asked me and that people might ask when they see this data, one of which is, well, if you think consciousness is primary, where did it come from? The answer that seems to make the most sense to me is that we have to first rethink the notion of time, which is really hard to do because in our day-to-day lives, it seems like time goes from past to present to future. And yet what I'm describing here, and many others have described this, is that the consciousness exists beyond space and time. And we see effects that I talk about, for example, precognition, which is where the future it seems to be affecting the past, where people are actually picking up the future in the present. So it's suggesting that this arrow of time isn't necessarily what we think it is or the way we perceive it. So that informs the question of where did consciousness come from? Because that question, in the question, it assumes that time is linear, that it goes from past to present to future, that there was some before. What I argue is that construct of linear time, as hard as this is to conceptualize, is actually an illusion, and time doesn't exist in that way. So there is no before consciousness, and rather consciousness simply is.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because now when it comes to the topic of time, you know, not our perception of it being linear, wherein I've had, you know, many people who are intuitive in nature, you know, indicated that whenever they kind of tune into whatever that is, that, you know, the idea of time is non-existent. So and it was just a literally a construct for humans to be able to organize thoughts and activity. And I agree with you that, you know, the idea of where did it come from, you know, implies that there was a beginning. With the idea that it is something that has always existed. I mean, that it's, it is, you know, how does that idea, you know, affect us who are living a linear experience?
Well, it's, you know, we do have this perception of a linear reality. To me, the biggest implication of not only understanding this concept of time, but also the concept that the consciousness is the fundamental part of the universe is all part of an alignment with the actual reality that it exists rather than the illusory reality. And when I say illusory, I don't mean that things aren't real, but maybe they're just not real in the way that we perceive them to be real. And with that alignment, I think, comes just a greater understanding of who and what we are. And time is one piece of that. So that's how I've looked at it, of, okay, I'm not a body that has a consciousness, but the more likely answer is that I'm a consciousness existing beyond space and time that's not limited to a body, but which is experiencing the body as a way of having an experience of a physical world.
Okay, so now as far as practical application, you know, with that understanding of being a part of consciousness that is experiencing has this human experience, in the day-to-day environment, you know, work, play, all that kind of thing. How does that help me if I were to adopt and recognize that paradigm as what is? What effect? I mean, how would my existence, my behavior, my day-to-day life be impacted with that knowledge? You know what I'm saying? Integrating that into my day-to-day life would be kind of displayed or manifested as how.
Okay, so there are three categories of ways that it can affect someone on a day-to-day basis. One is in the fact that if consciousness isn't localized to us, then the notion of psychic abilities is completely conceivable. And in an end to upside down thinking, I showed the evidence that we all have abilities that we haven't really been taught about, and it's a matter of harnessing them and strengthening our intuition. So there are ways to utilize abilities that we are not conventionally taught to think about. So that can enhance our lives in business, in relationships, and otherwise. So that's one category of we're much more than we have been taught to think we are. Another is, if consciousness isn't limited to the body, then when the body dies, consciousness does not die. And I think many people have an underlying fear of death, either for themselves or for others, that they're going to lose someone or they're going to lose themselves. If that fear of death is actually not warranted based on scientific evidence, then I think a lot of people's fears could maybe not fully dissipate, but they could be lessened, and that has a big effect on day-to-day lives. But to me, the biggest impact of all this and biggest implication is the notion that we're not actually separate, even though it looks like we are. So going back to the stream analogy, we're all made of water, even though we're individual whirlpools within that stream of water. We're all just consciousness. So that means that this notion of you versus me is just an illusion in the physical setting. And at the core basic level of existence, we're all the same. So that has massive implications for how we think about treating one another, whether it's a family member or someone who's just a stranger on the street. We are all connected in ways that we don't see. And so how would we treat one another if we thought you were me? You know, think about altruism. Altruism is how the idea that people like to help one another. Well, if we're all the same, then altruism is just a form of selfishness. It's the highest form of selfishness. By helping someone else, you are helping yourself at the core level. So that could transform how people interact with others on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. And, you know, the idea of recognizing, you know, that consciousness does not die when the body does, you know, it's for some people, you know, the idea of their consciousness going on, you know, living beyond their life. In one sense, it can be that comforting aspect, knowing that, you know, all of what I'm experiencing and everything goes on, you know, in some way, shape, or form. But then there's also the realization that, dang, I better be good, you know, because, you know, if this goes on, I'm not going to, you know, just live a life and then at the end dump everything and, you know, everything I've done, good and bad, you know, gets carried on, you know, doesn't get carried on. So, I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of like creating a, recognizing that if consciousness goes on, that my day-to-day interactions with life, with people and just, you know, relationships, just in general, being a good person, that it's really more important to give attention to doing good rather than, you know, having, you know, a beyond life consciousness of all of the hurt and pain I may have caused while, you know, while living in this human existence.
Totally. So I've heard people have different reactions to this, the same idea. Some people say it's very reassuring to know that it's not over with this life. But on the other hand, that it puts more pressure on people because things actually mean something. And there's a phenomenon as part of the near-death experience, which is chapter 9 of my book, it's known as the life review, where people are, these are people who are in cardiac arrest, for example, where they're clinically dead. And there are a whole bunch of reasons that I describe which suggest that the near-death experience is not simply a hallucination. But what people describe in this life review during the near-death experience is that they are seeing their whole life in a flash, and they're judging themselves for how they acted towards other people. And in some cases, they experience things from the eyes of those they affected. So if Bob is having his life review, and during his life he harmed Jane, he might experience the life review through Jane's eyes and feel the pain that he inflicted on her, and he feels badly about the way he acted, comes back into his body, and changes the way he thinks about his interactions as a result of the experience.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And we're halfway through the show already, Mark. I want to take just a quick break, and then when we come back, you know, you talk about many of those types of paranormal kinds of activities and realities, and you talk about having evidence. So I'd like to come back from the break and then talk about some of those abilities, and maybe just a little bit of the evidence that you encountered with those, okay?
Looking
forward
to it.
Everyone stay tuned. Great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us. And again, just an additional bit of information in the addition to iTunes. Our podcast show is now available on TuneIn and also on iHeartRadio. So if you use any of those platforms, be sure to subscribe to the show for free. Again, today my very special guest is Mark Gober, and we are talking about his new book, An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is www.markgober.com. That's MarkGober.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Mark.
All right.
Hello? All right, there we go. All right, so I'd like to explore and just kind of maybe if you can give us just a little bit insight on each of these kind of abilities that will certainly get the listeners' interest piqued about the topics that you cover. So first of all, you know, telepathic abilities. You mentioned a little bit about, you know, psychic abilities. As far as evidence, what is some of the evidence that you uncovered that supports, you know, the idea of its existence?
Sure. So there's a bunch of evidence that I will discuss. I want to take one quick step back to address something that I'm often asked about, where we're talking about this idea that consciousness doesn't come from the brain and that it exists independently. And people often ask, well, don't we know that consciousness is related to the brain? Like someone gets in a car accident or they have Alzheimer's and their consciousness is affected. Doesn't that prove that the brain produces consciousness? It does not prove it, because just because two things are related to one another doesn't mean that one always causes the other. So, for example, if you have a fire and lots of firefighters show up, correlation between the fire and the presence of firefighters. However, the firefighters did not cause the fire. They're related, but it's not causal. We might have something similar here where the brain is not the producer of consciousness, but rather it's more like an antenna receiver or a filtering mechanism of consciousness that would allow for these phenomena like telepathy to occur. So I just wanted to give that preface because it will make some of these phenomena seem less crazy if you view the brain more as like a processor of consciousness. So with telepathy, if we think of consciousness not being limited or confined to our bodies, then the notion that you could pick up what someone else is thinking or intending, that is not totally crazy. It's sort of like the whirlpool analogy where I'm in one whirlpool and another person's in another whirlpool. Let's say I open my whirlpool up a little bit and I allow in water from the other person's whirlpool. That's like a telepathic ability. That's like consciousness from somewhere else entering my mind. So what's the scientific evidence that that is actually possible for anybody? Because according to mainstream thinking, that should never happen. There's a study known as the Ganzfeld experiment, G-A-N-Z-F-E-L-D, and that's been done over many decades. Many different experimenters have done it. Dr. Dean Radin, who's at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, in his recent book, Real Magic, he talks about studies or different phenomena in this psychic realm that have achieved Six Sigma statistical results. And Six Sigma means that the odds that what we're seeing is just a chance occurrence is more than a billion to one. So in any area of science, typically, if it's not a paranormal one, we accept Six Sigma results as being a meaningful thing, that there's a real effect here. The Ganzfeld is a Six Sigma type of result. The basic design is as follows. You have one person in a room put into a very relaxed state, listening to relaxing music. We'll call that person Mike. So Mike's in that one room. You have Sally in another room. Sally is looking at a picture that the experimenters gave her. And the experimenters say, Sally, we want you to mentally send an image of this to Mike while he's in the other room. So Mike's not looking at the picture with his eyes. He's simply in the other room just being relaxed. The experimenters then show Mike four pictures after Sally has been sending a mental image allegedly for a while. And we would expect, if there were no effect, that Mike would guess correctly. If he were to guess which of the four Sally was sending to him mentally, we would guess that he would be correct one out of four times, 25%. However, what do we find over many trials, over many different experimenters, when you combine all the data? It's closer to 32%, which suggests that some information seems to be getting through, and that is, from a statistical standpoint, massively significant.
Yeah, you know, that is, you know, when you look at that statistical significance of that, you know, that's, it seems that whenever you encounter that kind of what are the odds, you know, situations, that it really should, you know, if you're in a scientific or, you know, curiosity mindset, that it should lead you to wonder what it is that is allowing for that to happen. Now, with the telepathic abilities, you know, you use the idea of you know, radio and kind of tuning in. Is the ability to have that connection, is it both sender and receiver? Is it the necessity for both sender and receiver to have like levels, so to speak, of abilities, or the ability to, you know, I mean, some people, I'm one of the kind that I think I'm a better receiver than I am a transmitter, you know, because whenever I get lots, I tend to pick up on lots of stuff, but whenever I try to send out information, it's not so much. So, you know, is it important to have both sender and receiver kind of in sabbatical in order to be able to maybe maximize that kind of thinking or ability?
Part of the reason I decided to write this book is that questions like this are not well understood yet because the research hasn't been done fully. And I think we need more funding to look at these things empirically because it's really important. But there are data points that I would point to that at least give hints at the answers. There are studies, for example, done by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who's a former Cambridge biochemist, looking at telephone telepathy. So these are cases where people seem to know who's calling before the caller calls and in a non-random way. And those types of abilities seem to be heightened when there's an emotional closeness between the parties. This also happens with the sense of being stared at when people are being stared at when they're not looking with the eyes. So let's say someone's in a room and they're being stared at by video camera. The person who's in the room seems to know beyond chance when they're being stared at by video camera. It's like the intention is being transmitted somehow non-physically. So there seems to be something related to emotional closeness. So same family or maybe husband-wife, that these abilities are heightened. We also see more of it with twins, identical twins in particular, where they seem to know things about what the other is doing or feeling at a distance. So that's one factor. But beyond that, I mean, we're still trying to understand why is it that 32% is for the general public. These are people who are not highly trained in psychic abilities. These are not the people who were at the U.S. government program, for example, which is a separate topic on remote viewing, who are the superstar psychics. But there are some cases of autistic savants, for example. So these are people who have highly impaired brains. In some ways, they really can't communicate well, but they're brilliant. They have incredible mathematical abilities or they have incredible memories. There are some reports from some pretty credible doctors. So Dr. Diane Powell is one who's a former Harvard Medical School faculty member, and she was at Johns Hopkins MD. Daryl Treffert, who studied Kim Peek. He was the person that the movie Rain Man was based off of. They are both reporting that sometimes there are autistic savants who are able to read their mother or their caregiver's mind at close to 100%, where the mother or caregiver is looking at something, looking at a word, and the child is able to type it out without actually seeing it. So it's like they're reading their mother or caretaker's mind without any other knowledge that they're getting. Now, the studies have to be controlled a bit better before we can draw conclusions, but it suggests that maybe the fact that they have such a damaged brain in certain ways is actually heightening their antenna receiver, so to speak, that allows them to be better receivers of information than a normal person.
Hmm. That, you know, that's very interesting. Yeah, because, you know, I've heard, you know, it said that, you know, when one person, one of their senses is somehow not working to its fullest, that the other senses will then kind of kick in to be able to give as full of a picture as possible, you know, without that sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but these are really important ideas that if we had more studies going on at mainstream institutions, I think we might have better answers. And right now we're just trying to use the few data points that we have and extrapolate from there.
Yeah. Why do you think, I mean, is it just mainstream science doesn't like the idea of having to shift their worldview and their paradigm, you know, systems that they've been working with for, you know, years and decades, hundreds of years? Is it just the fear of having to update those paradigms that is why maybe that research isn't being conducted?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think there are many very smart people who have built careers based on a certain way of thinking, and to have to admit that one was wrong or that their theories are incomplete, certain people are not willing to do that. And if there are people in places of influence that have that kind of mentality, it can be difficult to change paradigms. There's an analogy I love if we compare this to what Galileo faced. He had his evidence in the telescope, which suggested that contrary to the mainstream thinking back then, the Earth is not the center of the solar system, and that, in fact, the Earth revolves around the sun. That was a very controversial statement, convicted of heresy, but he had his evidence in his telescope, if the clergyman would have just looked. But the clergyman did not want to look in the telescope. So we have an emerging body of evidence, which I think, like I mentioned, there are some credible institutions that have run good studies. And I don't think our mainstream scientists are looking in the telescope, one, for fear probably of having to shift worldviews, but also these ideas that we're discussing are not possible if you have a conventional materialist perspective that consciousness is limited to the brain and produced by the brain. These sorts of things are not possible at all. So if you stick with that framework, then why even study it?
Yeah, I can see that. You know, to me, if a person is a true scientist, you know, in the sense of really, you know, having that height of inquiry, you know, that, you know, recognition of something that exists that doesn't fit into the worldview, to me, it would seem almost exciting, you know, to try and find out why, you know, what is it, you know, that we've been missing all these years, and maybe even to be one to, quote, discover the, you know, the correlation or the connection or the reasoning behind some of it. And, you know, to me, it just seems like that would be a, you know, but I do know, you know, how, you know, conventional science works, how business works, and you know, the application of grant money and all that kind of thing, and how it kind of would dampen that. But from a true scientific perspective, you know, it would seem to me that it would be exciting to try to find out why, you know, why this all happens.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I would think, too. It seems almost unscientific to discard data because it doesn't match our worldview. That's almost a dogmatic, or even it's a form of religion in a way, where it's a belief system and anything that falls outside the belief system is not studied. That is, I think, problematic if we want to advance our science and our medicine and the way we think about existence.
Yeah, I agree. I think once we get to the point of having, you know, more evidence and more scientific or more just more definitive kinds of answers, you know, I think we're going to be opening up a whole world, especially when it comes to medicine and treatment of some of the ailments that people, you know, are experiencing in a whole new, not costly manner.
I completely agree with you. And that's why another reason I decided to write the book is that if we want to make these advancements, I think we have to start looking in these areas.
I agree. So now we talked a little bit about precognition, you know, the idea of being able to know something in the future, in the present. As far as evidence, well, let me just give you an anecdotal one before I ask you for the evidence. I had one precognition experience in my entire life about 20 some odd years ago when I dreamt of my sister, you know, basically having an argument with a spirit, and I was the mediator between the two, and ended up getting them talking to each other, and then and the spirit's name was Ryan, and a couple, you know, months later, my sister-in-law had a baby, and Ryan, the name Ryan wasn't even on the short list, and then suddenly it was. And that was one of those I had documented my dream, and, you know, and even what I went through to try and make sense out of it. So I know it happens, and it hasn't happened since, you know, to my knowledge, I haven't had it documented, but so I know that does happen. But from your research and evidence, can you talk a little bit about precognition, and is this something that we can strengthen within ourselves?
Well, there are a number of anecdotal cases of precognitive dreams that are very vivid, and then they end up happening in reality later. And sometimes they're documented, sometimes they're not. So I do discuss those. But the example that has been done most rigorously in this true scientific sense or conventional scientific sense is studies that measure how the body responds to a picture before the picture is even shown. So in a conventional psychological experiment, if you show somebody an arousing picture, so this is might be a picture that's of a violent image or an erotic image, the person's body will unconsciously respond. So the skin will respond, the eyes, pupils will dilate, the brain and the heart will have certain responses. We know that from psychology. You show a picture, the body responds in a direction consistent with that picture. If we show somebody a picture of a river or a mountain, they're not going to have the same kind of response. So what the experimenters have done is reversed in time that exact type of experiment where they're measuring the body before a picture is shown. So a person who's in the experiment is looking at a screen, and the screen is showing randomly it's an arousing image or a peaceful image in a totally random fashion, and nobody knows what's going to come up, even the experimenters, because it's done randomly by a computer. The person who's looking at the screen has their body measured in one of those various ways. Their skin, their eyes, their ears, I mean their brain, their heart is being measured. And what the experimenters find, again, using statistics, it's very subtle, is that a few seconds before the picture is shown, the body responds in a way consistent with the picture that's eventually shown. So if it's an arousing image that's shown, the body will react to that seconds beforehand if you look at the statistics.
Wow, yeah. That's when you think about that, you know, to me it would cause you to kind of sit back and think that, you know, that maybe our reactions, you know, to situations and circumstances could maybe give us a little bit of forewarning in us being able to respond maybe more effectively than if it were just event response kind of situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's evidence if this is happening on an unconscious level, we can perhaps look at events and see if people were unconsciously responding in ways that are measurable beyond statistics. And there's one example that I discuss in the book is if you look at the flight occupancy rates on 9/11, the flights that hit the towers had a much lower occupancy rate than a normal plane. Now, is that a precognitive effect? Did people for some reason say, we know something bad is going to happen, I'm not going to take this flight, but they couldn't put their finger on it, or they found some reason not to get on the plane? It's hard to say, but it seems interesting that data point exists. In terms of how can we enhance the abilities, which is something that you asked, again, I think this is an area of research that needs to be explored more. Dr. Julia Mossbridge, who's at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, has studied this in depth, and I know it's something that she's looking at, which is how do we enhance precognition, because she's very much accepted that these phenomena are real and she ran a meta-analysis where you combine the studies on precognition, and it shows that there's a real effect when you look at all the trials that are done. But in general, there is the practice of meditation and sort of going into a trance-like state, quieting the mind, seems to be a way to enhance abilities, whether it's telepathic abilities or precognitive abilities. So that, I think, is a starting place for it.
Oh, great. Yeah, that definitely is. And I know that I've been open to having that happen again. So I continue to document dreams and just look at, the possibility of that precognitive kind of situation. One of the areas that you also talk about in your book is evidence about past lives. And I know a lot of people who just don't buy into that, the idea of past lives. Mm-hmm. So what is your, after you researched, what's your belief about them, and what was the evidence that led you to that belief?
Well, I'll start by saying that if you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have said there's like no way to explain how a past life could even be possible. If you think consciousness comes from the brain, and once the brain dies, it's over, how could a consciousness then continue to another body? That makes no sense at all. So if you buy into materialism, that the brain produces consciousness, then it is actually very logical to say that reincarnation is impossible. But if we switch the framework and we think of consciousness as being fundamental and primary, where consciousness is the stream of water that is reality, it's sort of like somebody's whirlpool dissolving, their body dies, and then reconfiguring into a different whirlpool. And that's like reincarnation, basically consciousness transitioning into a different form. So it's at least conceivable in that framework. if we look at the evidence, to me, the strongest evidence comes from the University of Virginia. So again, a very credible institution that's looking at this. And they've been studying this for over 50 years. Children who have memories of a life that is not theirs. And these are children usually between the ages of 2 and 5, because before the age of 2, they're not speaking. And after the age of 5, either they don't feel comfortable talking about it, or sometimes they seem to forget. So it's a small window. And there are over 2,500 cases of children who have these memories. It's, you know, in some cases, they're verified by medical records, where the researchers are able to find a child find a person that died in the exact manner that the child is describing. Sometimes the children have preferences that don't make any sense, like they crave tobacco or alcohol, or they have a fear of water, and then in the past life they drowned, for example. But in the most compelling cases, I think, are the ones where children have birthmarks and physical deformities that match the way in which they describe dying in the previous life. Those are very difficult to explain, especially when there are medical records, person died in the exact manner that the child is talking about. So it's like something is being transferred from one life to another, whether it's memories or actual physical issues, that you can't really explain conventionally, especially when the details are so it's hard to come up with an alternative solution. And the researchers at the University of Virginia have concluded that reincarnation is the most likely explanation for this set of data.
Yeah, I agree. And I've, you know, watched shows all about, you know, the children, and actually even know a couple who have, indicated, you know, through their, indicated to me, you know, their beliefs, you know, or their memories, you know, that they say of, you know, previous existence. And it does seem that, you know, that at that very young age is a critical time, because they haven't been told or, you know, schooled not to believe in that, you know, and the filters are not, you know, there are fewer filters, if any, you know, to be able to kind of receive that information.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
So we're limited in the data that we can even obtain, because for that reason, you need to have parents that are even looking for it. And then you need a child that is describing this phenomenon. So it's not going to happen all the time, but there will be cases where the child's doing something that is so remarkable that the parents notice it and they don't just dismiss it and they talk to researchers about it. But the fact that we have 2,500 cases that are compelling, there are varying degrees of the strength of cases, but there shouldn't be any cases that are compelling under the mainstream perspective. And some are so detailed that these are little kids describing things that you just can't explain any other way.
Yeah, I agree. Now, we're kind of winding down for the hour, but one area I did want to talk about or ask about is the Elon Musk Neuralink, you know, that brain computer connection. If consciousness impacts brain, and reality and matter, how would this Neuralink, you know, this computer mind or brain connection, would that really have any impact on consciousness? I mean, or would consciousness adjust, so to speak, to that particular receptor?
The way I look at the Neuralink project, based on the little bits and pieces of data that we have on what he's doing, because Elon Musk hasn't disclosed all that much, but it sounds like he's trying to build a wizard hat for the brain. So looking at the ways that the brain can enhance our abilities, from what I've seen, it sounds like they're using a materialist perspective of the brain to build this wizard hat, this piece of machinery that can help with brain functioning. And I think they perhaps could do something even bigger if they viewed the brain to be more like an antenna receiver or a filtering mechanism. How could we use something like that to enhance psychic abilities artificially for people? So I mention it in that context of, well, maybe it's probably going to be a great product from a materialist perspective, but that's only a piece of the puzzle. We might be better served if we wanted to enhance abilities to think about the brain differently.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they need that upside down thinking. So my last question to you is, after all of this research and writing the book, how has this paradigm shift, this worldview shift, impacted your life? How is your life different because of that view?
It's different in so many ways. I mean, I think about existence differently, where I used to think I was in a finite existence that had no meaning at all. So that alone, going from thinking that there's no meaning to thinking that there is some meaning and that it's not just this body, that's it, that creates a whole new perspective. And then I think it ripples into all parts of life. But I mentioned the interconnectedness earlier, that piece where we're actually not separate.
Mm-hmm.
That changes things big time, because it adds significance and a sense of more equality to everything. That I think, I mean, it sounds like a really comforting and utopian perspective, and so I think it is just good conceptually, but it also seems to be the most likely picture of reality. So when we look at the world's problems today, many of them I think could be solved or improved if we appreciated that view of reality.
I agree. And, you know, the idea, you know, with that interconnectedness, I agree that, you know, compassion and empathy, you know, would rise greatly if we recognize that. And, you know, maybe seeing the world through someone else's eyes, like that life review. But how does that help one with things that are going on around you that are like completely contrary to your beliefs, you know, or people who are just, you know, they just agitate you, or situations that just agitate you? How does that connectedness help manage that the response or the internal feelings that an individual would have?
Well, I think it's maybe more disturbing to see the things that are happening in the world, because to me, they're happening based on just a misunderstanding of reality, and people are acting based on just this faulty set of assumptions. And I there's only so much that any one person can do about that. I think just for those
right.
who are open to these ideas, that's what I'm hoping to do with An End to Upside Down Thinking, is to expose those who are interested to the ideas, but certainly not everyone will be. And there's only so much that any one person can do. So I think it's a matter of conducting one's own life in a way that seems to make sense. And for me, this reality seems to make the most sense more than any other picture I've seen. And then that informs how we behave, I think.
That's perfect. Well, Mark, I really want to thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation and your book. And I hope it does, and I'm sure it will, open up the eyes of many people, you know, and shift their perspective. Because it's, you know, once you have that perspective, life can be much happier and more fulfilling. And you know, making choices would be easier. You know, making the right choices would be easier if you take that kind of perspective.
I completely agree with you. And thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure again, and I'm looking forward to following your journey on Facebook, and people can connect with you on various social media platforms, and you have that available on your website. So, again, thank you very much, Mark.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Mark Gober. We've been talking about his new book, Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness, and the implications for everyday life. Again, you can find out more about Mark by visiting his website, which is markgober.com, markgober.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. And definitely go to Amazon and pick up his book. It's very thoughtful, and I'm sure you'll find it delightful. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.